Okay, this is, as we all know, the Feast of Unleavened Bread for 7 days, and at this time of the year, this season of the year, when we're talking of Passover, the Exodus, ancient Israel, things of that nature, it's good to stick with material that relates to these days. We have 50 odd weeks of the year when we can talk about whatever we want. But at this time, it seems useful to look at scriptures that have some bearing upon these days. And you'll recollect already that in looking at Passover, we saw that when Passover was over, when the firstborn of Egypt, including the animals, had been killed, and ancient Israel had been passed over, they were still, of course, in Egypt. They were still in slavery, really. Pharaoh was still alive, the armies were still there, and the people were still living in the land of bondage. So they couldn't just stay there. And we said before, we can't just accept Jesus as our Passover and just stay there. Some action is required. And so ancient Israel packed up, got lots of gold and silver, got their cattle together, and they left Egypt. And on the night to be much remembered or observed, we commemorated that. And we saw on the first holy day that we are to leave sin behind us. We are to leave Egypt. We are to leave slavery. We're going on a journey. Our journey from bondage into the promised land. In our case, a journey into God's kingdom. Takes action, doesn't it? But when we set out on that journey, I suppose the question is, will it be all plain sailing? Will it be all simple, straightforward? Will times be sunny and rosy, not a problem in sight? What can we expect as we make our journey to God's kingdom? And what might be one of the worst things that you and I could do on that journey? Well, thankfully, the scriptures do give us some insight. So today we open our Bibles at 1 Corinthians chapter 10, and beginning in verse 1, we'll start to see some of the issues that ancient Israel met, and hopefully see areas where you and I better learn our lessons. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, and beginning in verse 1. Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea, the Red Sea, all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, all ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. So here's Paul talking about the Exodus. Ancient Israel leaving Egypt with a high hand. And notice that all of these people were essentially baptized. All were eating of that same spiritual food and spiritual drink. All of them. That sounds great, doesn't it? Fantastic. All of them left Egypt. All of them heading for the promised land. All. Great. But, verse 5 starts with a but. You know, yeah, but. And there is a big but, because it says, but, with most of them, not just a few, but with most of them, you could say, I guess, the majority of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now, hold on a moment. Here's God bringing out, you know, 2 million or 3 million or whatever from bondage, from slavery, bringing them to the promised land. What on earth has happened if the majority of them died and their bodies are scattered around the desert? What went wrong? And more importantly, is there a lesson for us? Well, verse 6, just in case we aren't sharp. Now these things became our examples. That means that these things are for our examples. That means we can learn. That means we should learn, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. And we do not become idolaters as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. And we'll get to that particular scripture later. Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. Nor, and so you get the point here, Paul saying these people did lots of bad things. Now let's make sure that we don't do these things, because these things that happened to them are examples to us. They are to teach us. Carrying on, he says, verse 9, nor let us tempt or test or provoke Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. Nor, and you might say, well, wait a second, you're not going to find me testing the Lord or committing sexual immorality or becoming an idolater. Not me. But if that is the case, I'll bet a few people fall into verse 10, nor murmur.
Ooh.
As some of them murmured and were destroyed by the destroyer. I guess that's the destroyer that destroyed the firstborn on Passover night. But it says, don't murmur. Other translations are, don't grumble. Mustn't grumble. Mustn't grumble. But it's an Israelite trait. Grumble, grumble, grumble. Murmur, murmur, murmur. Mutter, mutter, mutter. Or other translation is be discontented. Ever met anybody who's murmured, grumbled, or been discontented? Do you know anybody like that? Do you know somebody very closely and intimately like that? And then verse 11 says, now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition or warning, on whom the ends of the ages have come. So these things aren't just histories to be overlooked, ignored. These things are written down, it says, for our instruction, for our warning, for our admonition, us on whom the ends of the ages have come. And you might say, well, thankfully none of that applies to me. You know, I'm strong spiritually. I've got mighty spiritual muscles. I'm all right, Jack. And in that case, here's verse 12. Therefore let him who thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall. So we are smug, then it still applies to us. Verse 13, and no temptation, test, or trial has overtaken you, except such as is common to man. And what ancient Israel went through, actually, there's nothing particularly new under the sun. The same issues that they stumbled, the same ones that you and I are likely to stumble over. It says, but God is faithful. For his part, God is faithful. God is faithful. He's faithful. He'll not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation or test or trial will also make the way of escape, that you may be able to bear it. And of course, in a sense, when Israel came to the Red Sea, which was impassable, a way of escape was created miraculously. And God's still in the business of performing miracles. But we can see here in this particular chapter alone that there are lessons that ancient Israel went through, the episodes in their journey are recorded for you and me to benefit from. There are things that you and I can learn there. So let's turn back to Numbers chapter 14 and verse 19. Book of Numbers chapter 14. Because we're going to look at some of their examples today. These things that were written down for our warning, our instruction. Numbers chapter 14. And beginning in verse 19. And this is takes place at the borders of the Promised Land, where Israel finally rejects its opportunity to go over, and God's got rather angry at this point, And Moses has interceded and asking God not to wipe them out there on the spot. Verse 19, pardon the iniquity of this people, I pray, according to the greatness of your mercy, just as you have forgiven this people from Egypt even until now. And we'll see there have been a number of times when God had been provoked. And Moses is saying, you know, you've had to forgive them again and again and again. Please do so one more time. And verse 20, then the Eternal said, okay, Moses, I have pardoned according to your word. But truly, as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Eternal, because all these men who have seen my glory and the signs which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness and have put me to the test now these 10 times and have not heeded my voice, they certainly shall not see the land which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who rejected me see it. But my servant Caleb, because he has a different spirit in him and has followed me fully, I will bring into the land where he went, and his descendants shall inherit it, and also Joshua 2. But verse 22 is the one we're going to look at. It says here, you know, God's talking to Moses, and he says, okay, I'm not going to exterminate them right here and now, but look, these people have put me to the test. One translation says, have provoked me these 10 times. So between leaving Egypt a few months earlier and here at the borders of the Promised Land, they had tested, tempted, tried God 10 times, and he says, that is it. That's the end. That's the last time. From now on, they're going to die in the wilderness, and we'll come to that a bit later on. Now, some people say that when it talks of 10 times, it's just a sort of expression meaning they provoke me a lot, a great deal. But you can actually find 10 occasions where they have provoked God, and we're going to look at those 10 occasions today. We've actually done this a few years ago, but it's very, I think, appropriate this time of year when we're talking of ancient Israel and Passover and Exodus to look at just what they did. But obviously, what we're trying to say is, let's make sure that we don't do what they did. And because, in essence, their big problem was they had an evil heart of unbelief. And today's message would be, don't have an evil heart of unbelief. Don't have an evil heart of unbelief. And that's precisely what they had. So let's turn to the first of our 10 provocations of God, which we'll find in Exodus chapter 14. Turn to Exodus chapter 14 and verse 5. You remember the Exodus description was Exodus 12. Passover, so we're only just a matter of a chapter or so later than that. So we're taking up the events immediately after the night to be much remembered. So Exodus chapter 14, and picking up the story in verse 5. And here we read, now it was told the king of Egypt, that's Pharaoh, that the people had fled, and the heart of Pharaoh and his servants was turned against the people, and they said, why have we done this, that we've let Israel go from serving us? You might have thought it was pretty obvious, you know, the country was in ruins at this stage, you know, plagues of flies and locusts and you know, frogs, and the firstborn died and everything else. But anyway, memories appear to be extremely short. Verse 6, so he made ready his chariot and took his people with him. Also he took 600 choice chariots and all the chariots of Egypt with captains over every one of them. And the Eternal hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the children of Israel, and the children of Israel went out with boldness. Now we know that on that first night to be much remembered, they were rejoicing, fantastic, we're free, got all this gold and silver, and we're off to a land flowing with milk and honey, fantastic. And they went off joyfully. And we, I think, saw the parallels, you know, you and I, when we're first called and we accept Jesus as our Passover lamb and are baptized, we can start off sometimes with great enthusiasm, great joy, fantastic. I'm one of God's chosen, one of his elect. I'm on the journey now, the kingdom of God. Here I come. Verse 9. So the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, and also his horsemen and his army, and overtook them camping by the sea beside Pi-Hahiroth before Baal-Zephon. I think sometimes people think there's only 600 chariots involved, but there's more than that. There's the cavalry as well, and the army of Pharaoh, Josephus. I'm not sure whether he was accurate or not, but for what it's worth, Josephus, who was a Jewish historian around about the time of Christ, he said that there were 50,000 horsemen and 200,000 foot soldiers in this army. So if he was accurate, you're looking at a quarter of a million military men chasing down these recently released slaves. So physically, this would be quite scary, wouldn't it? Well, would it? What would you be like in that situation if you turn around, you're by the beach, which means that you've got water in front of you, and mountains to a couple of sides, and on the other side, heading towards you are 50,000 cavalry, 200,000 foot soldiers with spears and crossbows and bows and arrows and grenades and you name it, and they're after you. Well, verse 10, when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. So they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Eternal. And they said to Moses, "Hallelujah, God is with us. Come on, brother, sort them out." Or, "Because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, 'Let us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians as slaves'? For would it not have been better to serve the Egyptians than we should die in the wilderness?" So what do you get straight away? Fear, grumbling, accusations, doubt, unbelief. And you might say, well, to be fair, there's water on one side and soldiers heading their way, but don't forget, in the preceding weeks there's been frogs and flies and locusts and fire and brimstone, and the firstborn killed miraculously. These people have seen already, before they left Egypt, God's intervention, his power, his might. They've been released miraculously from Egypt. So where's their faith? Where's their confidence? They're just walking entirely by sight, are they not? Now, of course, for you and I, we'd never do that. We'd never allow situations, would we, around us to cause us to doubt, would we? Unlike ancient Israel, we're people who are strong spiritually. We walk by faith and not by sight. You won't find us doubting, murmuring, grumbling, would you? Or would you? Well, I think the answer is you jolly well would. And sometimes when we do start going God's way, we hit all manner of problems. Job problems, suddenly the Sabbath becomes an issue. The holy days become a problem. Oh, I didn't expect this to happen. What's happened is Satan's come after you with his demons, stirring up problems. And at that stage, you have to decide, is it now time to start moaning and whinging and grumbling and complaining and doubting and looking at the situation and saying it's impossible, it can't work? Or do we say, well, just a moment, I trust God. I'm going God's way, I'm following God's instructions, I'm heading for the kingdom of God, God's chosen me, I'm with him, he's with me, absolutely no problem. I'm walking by faith and I'm not moved by what I see or hear. And you know I have that choice. But for ancient Israel, they'd start already within a matter of a couple of days, their whinging starts. Verse 13, and Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Eternal, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever. The Eternal will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace." and probably nothing's changed. That's still the case today. The Eternal shall fight for you and me. It's not up to us to sort of struggle and be anxious and worried. We have a great champion. And the Eternal said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward. But lift up your rod, stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it. And the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea." And that's what happened. Pretty good. And of course, it was a miracle if you'd stood there on that evening, looking out at the miles and miles of sea and thinking, well, we're stuck, aren't we? But suddenly, the waters open up and dry land appears, and it says, they escape through that. Verse 17, "I indeed will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them. So I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, his chariots, and his horsemen." So it implies that the entire military of Egypt was about to be destroyed. "Then the Egyptians shall know that I am the Eternal when I have gained honor for myself over Pharaoh, his chariots, and his horsemen. And the angel of God who went before the camp of Israel moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud went from before them and stood behind them. So it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel." So it separated the two camps. "Thus it was a cloud and darkness to the one, and they gave light by night to the other. So the one did not come near the other all that night. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Eternal caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on the dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. And the Egyptians pursued and went after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen." All pretty exciting stuff. Be great to have a DVD, perhaps, of these events and just watch it was real, took place. They think they've discovered the particular part of the Red Sea where ancient Israel crossed over, and they've found chariot wheels and so on at the bottom of the water there, all now sort of corroded and rusted over, encrusted with barnacles and who knows what on. So they think they found that spot. Amazing. Verse 24, "Now it came to pass in the morning watch that the Eternal looked down upon the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud, and he troubled," or confused, "the army of the Egyptians." He took off their chariot wheels. And I've seen photographs of what appear to be chariot wheels. "So they drove them with difficulty. And the Egyptians said, 'Let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Eternal fights for them against the Egyptians.' Then the Eternal said to Moses, 'Stretch out your hand over the sea, that the waters may come back upon the Egyptians, on their chariots and on their horsemen.' And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and when the morning appeared, the sea returned to its full depth, while the Egyptians were fleeing into it. So the Eternal overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. Then the waters returned and covered the chariots, the horsemen, and all the army of Pharaoh." And that's possibly, if Josephus is right, 250,000 people. "Not so much as one of them remained. But the children of Israel had walked on dry land in the midst of the sea, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. So the Eternal saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Thus Israel saw the great work which the Eternal had done in Egypt. So the people feared the Eternal and believed the Eternal and his servant Moses." Which sounds fantastic. And let's face it, was that a miracle or not? You just watched the final might of Egypt destroyed overnight. Several hundred thousand, perhaps. And there you are as a slave people with your little children, your babies, your cattle, your sheep, lambs, oxen, whatever. And you've gone through several miles of seawater on dry land safe, and all of Egypt is military might now destroyed. Would you not believe God? Like, for longer than a day or two, because that's the problem. So that was the first time they provoked God by saying, did you bring us out here, Moses, to kill us? We'd been better off back in Egypt in slavery. So whinging and grumbling and doubting, you know, God's provision, God's protection. This sounds good so far. They've now finally seen the light. They've seen 10 plagues in Egypt and now another massive miracle. So now everything is fine. Well, Exodus 15 and verse 22. This will be the second of the 10 times they provoke God. Exodus 15 and verse 22. So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea. Then they went out into the wilderness of Shur, and they went, look, 3 whole days. Right? So these people are strong in faith. But of course, there are lessons here for us. They went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. And they said to themselves, well, no problem. God is our provider, El Shaddai. He'll provide water for us. We've seen what he's done so far. But of course, that's not what they said. Verse 23. Now when they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore the name of it was called Marah. And the people, here they go again, murmured against Moses, saying, what shall we drink? Murmured meaning grumbled, complained, criticized, accused, abused. The Bible's being rather brief here. Just imagine these people probably for hours and hours, half a day, they were just muttering and mumbling and grumbling and depressed and getting hostile and agitated. And what's the problem? Problem is they have no trust in God. They are unthankful for their freedom thus far. They don't see God anywhere. All they see is, we're in the desert, we're thirsty, there's no water, there's no way. Their mindset is one of always looking at the physical, always doubting God's provision, and always ready to complain at the drop of a hat. They don't see God anywhere in this. Verse 25, so Moses cried out to the Eternal, and the Eternal showed him a tree. When he cast it into the waters were made sweet. As a miracle. There he, God, made a statute and an ordinance for them, and he tested them and said, if you diligently heed the voice of the Eternal your God, which they've not been doing, and do what is right in his sight, such as trusting him, give ear to his commandments and keep all his statutes, I'll put none of the diseases on you which I have brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Eternal who heals you. There's a promise there. I am Jehovah Rapha. I am God your healer. Of course, you know, people don't have much trust in that today either. But here they are, already complaining against God, complaining about the fact that, you know, we're thirsty. We're thirsty. Thirsty, don't you understand? Thirsty. And because we'd never complain, so this lesson really doesn't apply to us. Let's move to Exodus chapter 16, just a verse or two later, and we're now into the third time that they provoke, because God is being provoked by this. Don't forget, God is faithful. That means he's trustworthy. That means he will never, never, never let them down or us down. So every time that there's doubt, accusation, finger pointing, essentially saying, you can't trust God. Can't put your faith in God. After all, you never know what God's going to do you? Well, chapter 16 and verse 1. So now they've got water, so surely by now, having been, you know, rescued and brought through the Red Sea and seen on the entire armies of Egypt destroyed, having seen water now produced sweetly, you know, lovely, refreshing, delicious water in the desert, now finally, the penny's dropped. Now finally they understand that God can and will provide for them. Correct? Well, verse 1. And they journeyed from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after they departed from the land of Egypt. So they departed on the 15th day of the first month. This was a month later, 15th day of the second month. So only 4 weeks from when they left. And it didn't take them too long, does it, to get into the habit. Verse 2, then the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. That's like everybody. And maybe there's an exception or two, but it says the whole congregation, the whole bunch of them, murmured, that is, grumbled, complained, discontented. Verse 3, and the children of Israel said to them, oh, that we had died. This is strong language. Oh, only we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt when we sat by those pots of meat, those potluck suppers, those burgers, when we had bread to the full. For you, Moses and Aaron, have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. We're dying of hunger. We can't survive. Do they see God? No. What's uppermost in their minds? Their belly. Physical, material. Don't see God. Don't trust God. Walking by sight. Of course, I realize none of us would ever do that. But they did. And these things are written for our warning, our instruction. You know, I can't afford to go through life just satisfying the physical, the material, and ignoring God. Now, they went in and complained and grumbled, but, you know, God had a solution for them. You know, verse 4, it says, and the Eternal said to Moses, behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you. And the people shall go out and gather a certain quota every day, that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not. And it shall be in the sixth day that they shall prepare what they bring in, and it shall be twice as much as they gather daily. So God is going to provide them with manna, miraculously, day by day. And he's going to build it around a 7-day cycle. 6 days to give manna, and on the sixth day they get twice as much, and then they'd rest on the seventh day. And so God's going to provide them with the nourishment, the food they wanted, satisfy their bellies. And he's also going to test them about whether they keep the Sabbath, which was, like, you know, quite important. And so that was the third provocation there, whinging and complaining, we're going to die of hunger. Now, that really is an insult to God, who's bringing them. He said, look, I'm going to bring you to the land flowing with milk and honey. Now, if he means what he says, he's going to bring them to the land flowing with milk and honey, and he's going to get them there in good health and good spirits. So to whinge and complain repeatedly, as they were doing, shows a complete lack of confidence, lack of faith. Just don't trust him. So the fourth provocation we find in chapter 16, which is where we are, dropping down to verse 16. So the manna is now arriving, and there's some instructions as to keeping the Sabbath around it. This is the thing which the Eternal has commanded. Let every man gather it, the manna, according to each one's need, one omer for each person, according to the number of persons. Let every man take for those who are in his tent. And the children of Israel did so, and gathered some more, some less. So when they measured it by omers, he who had gathered much had nothing over. He who gathered little had no lack. Every man had gathered according to each one's need. And Moses said, let no one leave any of it till morning. Right? Don't get too much. You're not going to keep it overnight. It's not to happen. Notwithstanding, it says, verse 20, they did not heed Moses, but some of them left part of it until morning, and it bred worms and stank, and Moses was angry with them. You see, what was the problem? The problem was, you never know what God's are going to do. He sent some manna today, but who knows about tomorrow? Let's make sure we get plenty. Stack it up. Open the fridge, pile it in. And under the bed, under the mattress, because who knows, this God being might not give us any tomorrow. You know, can you trust him? Whoa, I don't know about that. I mean, God works in mysterious ways, his wonders to perform, and tomorrow there might be none. And so let's get plenty. And it was just disobedience. It was simple disobedience. And also it showed an attitude. You can't trust God to provide. Now you and I should be able to understand that, give us this day our daily bread, but often we like the security of piles and piles of stuff, just in case. Because, I mean, let's face it, as the hymn says, you never know what God's going to do. Well, you do. He's going to keep his word, which obviously these people did not believe. So they provoked him again. God's looking and thinking, what is the matter? You know, Moses was angry, but you know, we know that God was angry too. And so we move on to the fifth provocation, which is the same chapter, just a few verses later. So now we know they'd been keeping it overnight, which they were not to do. That was disobedient, that was rebellious, that showed a lack of confidence in God as provider. Verse 23, then Moses said to them, this is what the Eternal has said, tomorrow is a Sabbath rest. So this must have been on a Friday, this particular communication. Tomorrow is a Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to the Eternal. Bake what you will bake today, boil what you will boil, and lay up yourselves all that remains to be kept until the morning. This is different. In the other 6 days, you don't keep anything overnight. It'll breed worms and stink. So you just have today's, and that's the end of it. But on this day, Friday, no, you're going to get plenty, including enough for tomorrow. And it's going to be miraculously preserved, of course. Verse 24, so they laid up, they laid it up till morning, as Moses commanded, and it did not stink. Nor were there any worms in it. So that's another miracle. Then Moses said, eat that today, for today is a Sabbath to the Eternal. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, there will be none. So here we are, incidentally, in passing, a few weeks before we get to Exodus 20, because Exodus 16, if you're sharp, you'll realize it comes before Exodus 20. Exodus 20 is the Ten Commandments. So here we are predating the Ten Commandments, and the Sabbath is in place. And God's testing their obedience to the Sabbath, which is why we sometimes say the Sabbath is a test commandment. Will you or won't you do what God says about the Sabbath? And by the way, they wouldn't, some of them, because here's the provocation. Number 5, verse 27, now it happened that some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather, but they found none. Now what are they doing? And what are the people doing? Don't go out on the Sabbath day to gather. Get in twice as much on Friday. God will miraculously preserve it overnight. So here's just plain, simple disobedience. And the Eternal said to Moses, how long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? For see, for the Eternal has given you the Sabbath, therefore he gives you on the sixth day bread for 2 days. Let every man remain in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day to, you know, gather food. And so God was not pleased. That was just rank disobedience. They only had the commandment, you know, a few days, and instantly, almost, they're disobeying. These people are rebellious people, and they're not honoring and respecting God's holy Sabbath day. Now, of course, we know that we would never do that, because we're good people. They wouldn't find us cutting the Sabbath short to get on to something very important, or turning up for Sabbath a bit after sunset because we're busy doing our stuff in the world. We would never, you know, shortchange God's Sabbath, would we? We'd never be found doing anything on the Sabbath day that would be displeasing to God, would we? Of course not. I'm talking hypothetically here, but maybe somebody would somewhere, somebody you might know. So potentially it could happen. If it does happen, it's not something we should be doing, because these were written for our instruction, our warning. Okay, let's go on to the sixth provocation, which is Exodus chapter 17. Doesn't take too long, does it? Virtually verse after verse. Exodus 17, and beginning in verse 1. Then all the congregation of the children of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin, according to the commandment of the Eternal, and camped in Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. Now this should not be a problem, because water made sweet, brought through the Red Sea, fed with manna. I mean, by now, surely, even if you're not the brightest crane in the box, you realize that God is looking after us. Well, of course, these were Israelites, stubborn, stiff-necked. And it says, verse 2, therefore, there's no water, remember, they're going to be thirsty. Therefore, the people contended with Moses. That means argued. That means quarreled. That means their temper was up. That means Moses was getting hate mail every morning, his peace, evening, switch it on. Now 5,000 emails, all complaining and whinging. The people contended with Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. And Moses said to them, why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Eternal? Now Moses was aware of what's going on here. When they're shouting at Moses, because they can see him, and they can, you know, they can vent their spleen, so to speak, on this guy Moses. In reality, it's God they doubt. It's God they're accusing. It's supposed to be our provider. It's supposed to be El Shaddai, the Almighty, who looks after us. Don't think so. Here we are Thursday again. What sort of God would that be? It's provocative. God's not pleased at any of these times. We know when he got to the 10th, that was it. He just said, I put up with 10, that's the last one. I'm not taking any more of this from this bunch. Verse 3, and the people thirsted there for water, and the people murmured against Moses and said, why is it you brought us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? So, I mean, they were quite blunt, and they'd be, I imagine, quite rough, some of these folk, not all wearing top hats and tails, you know, polite, courteous. These were probably quite hard people, and when they're up against Moses and shouting into his face, you birds are you to kill us, well, you know, God's listening, he's hearing, and he's probably thinking, don't see much faith there. So Moses cried out to the Eternal, verse 4, and said, what shall I do with this people? They're almost ready to stone me. So these are not just little words. These people were, there's a lot of hostility here, a lot of anger among the people, a lot of doubt. And the Eternal said to Moses, go on before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel. Also, take in your hand your rod with which you struck the river and go. Behold, I'll stand before you there on the rock in Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water will come out of it, that the people may drink. Now there's a miracle or two. Get up by Mount Horeb, Mount Sinai, take this rod of yours and just go and whack the rock, and water, what, water will come out of a rock? Is that possible? Is that a miracle? Does that show that God can do anything? And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel, so he called the name of the place Massa, meaning tempted, and Meribah, meaning contention or quarreling, because of the contention of the children of Israel, and because they tempted the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? Now you talk of an insult. You know, is God with us or not? Excuse me, Egypt destroyed? Their armies drowned before your eyes. You actually saw their bodies and the horses and things on the, you know, floating in the Red Sea. You've had manna day by day by day, and miraculously is preserved into the Sabbath. You've had waters turn sweet. You had quail a bit earlier. It's like, what do you mean? Is the Eternal among us or not? You talk of provocative, and this was a bad one. I mean, we've only got a few verses here, but you can sort of certainly tell this was not a good time. God was not well pleased, and Moses calls the place Massa in Meribah. Actually names it, you know, temptation and contention. and it's actually quoted in Psalms, but we'll turn to Hebrews chapter 3. So hold your place here, because we're coming back more or less, I think, to this point. But Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 7. You can tell this is a bad one because it's quoted in Psalms 95, but also quoted here in Hebrews chapter 3. And picking up in verse 7, so the Apostle Paul, who was probably, well, I believe he was the author of Hebrews anyway, verse 7, therefore as the Holy Spirit says, now David was the one who actually wrote Psalms 95, but Paul says that David was inspired because he says the Holy Spirit is the author. Today, if you'll hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion in the day of trial in the wilderness. Now, the word rebellion in Hebrew is meribah, and the word trial there is massa. So you could say, do not harden your hearts as in meribah, in massa in the wilderness. It's quoting this particular episode, the one we just read back there in Exodus. Verse 9, where your fathers tested me, proved me, and saw my works in total 40 years. Therefore I was angry with that generation and said, they always go astray in their heart. They have not known my ways. So I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. You know, Paul's quoting the Psalms, and the psalmist was recounting the events that we've been reading about there in Exodus, particularly Massa and Meribah, and just saying, you know, that really provoked God that time. It was one of our, because a whole train of provocations and challenges, and even in later times, after the 10th one, it didn't stop there. That's the one that paid to the folk aged over 20. But it says, look, it says verse 10, they always go astray in their hearts. They have not known my ways. They don't know me. They don't understand my goodness, my provision, my faithfulness. They don't know me, the true God. Verse 12, beware, brethren. Oh, so this is suddenly taking those events and saying, actually, brethren, there's a lesson for you and me. Beware, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief. Hence the message is called, don't have an evil heart of unbelief, because that's precisely what they suffered from. Beware, brethren, lest there be in any of you called out once an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God, but exhort or encourage one another daily, while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. Now, the Feast of Unleavened Bread is all about putting sin out. I think we saw a couple of days ago that sin can be deceitful. Well, tells us again, sin can deceive. Leavens slowly, and it leavens the whole lump. It can be hidden and concealed, but it works its way, and eventually the leaven permeates, and you could say corrupts, and so it can be deceitful. Sin can be deceitful. Unbelief is dangerous. Verse 14, for we become partakers of Christ if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast to the end. What I've said today, if you'll hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion, as in Meribah and Massa. It says today, meaning don't put this off. This is not something to think about at the Feast of Unleavened Bread in 2012. today is, you know, it's not late enough. We need to get going like now, living God's way. Verse 16, for who, having heard, rebelled? Indeed, was it not all who came out of Egypt, led by Moses? A whole bunch of them rebelled. All these ones who were baptized in the Red Sea, baptized into Moses, all of them rebelled. Wouldn't be that all God's called out ones would be rebellious, would it? Now, with whom was he angry 40 years? Was it not those who sinned, whose corpses fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest, but to those who did not obey, or King James Version says, who believe not, which is probably a better translation. It means who were not persuadable. You couldn't persuade these people to believe. It says who did not obey, who believed not in the King James, but the Greek means you just couldn't persuade these people to believe. They'd see miracle after miracle and you could not get them to see and believe. They just refused. They refused to believe. It's a choice. You and I can always choose to believe or disbelieve, but you couldn't persuade them. Verse 19, so we see they could not enter in to the kingdom because of unbelief. Now, you and I don't want to be there. You and I should be persuadable. We should be believers, and believers are supposed to be believing. So we should be people who believe, who respond quickly to God, who do have faith in God, who do trust our God, and not be hard-hearted like these people. You just couldn't get through to them. Doesn't matter how many miracles God did. You know, the manna was every single day for 40 years, and you couldn't get through. So let's turn back to Exodus. So that was the sixth provocation. We're actually now going back to Exodus 32. A little bit later along, Exodus 32. Now again, if you're sharp, we go from Exodus 16, which was before the Ten Commandments. The commandments are in Exodus 20. Exodus 32, we're now after the commandments. So we've got to the point in Exodus 20, 21, 22, thereabouts, where the Old Covenant was set up and established, and all people said, yep, amen, brother, we want to be part of that. So only a matter of a few weeks have now elapsed, and we get to the seventh provocation, Exodus 32, beginning in verse 1. And Moses, you see, at this stage, is going back up the mountain, Mount Sinai, Mount Horeb, to, you know, some time with God. Verse 1, now when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, it's Mount Sinai, the people gathered together to Aaron and said to him, come, make us gods that shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. Now, this is provocative, because this is days after the Ten Commandments were given by God in his own voice. I am the Lord thy God, which have brought thee out of the land of Egypt. Out of thy bondage, thou shalt have no other gods before me. This is where they were. They're still there. They haven't moved away yet. This is still at Mount Horeb. These people literally heard God's voice thundering out the Ten Commandments a matter of days before. Now, if you were God and you were actually on that mountain at this time talking to Moses, and at the foot of the mountain people said, amen, brother, yep, we'll accept this covenant. And now they're saying, Aaron, don't know what's happened to this guy Moses. Come on, want to build us or make us a god. And verse 2, Aaron said, no way, let us faithfully obey and honor and respect the Almighty God Elohim, who has provided for us day by day on our journey to this point. Nope. Aaron said, well, okay, break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters. Interesting, the sons had earrings as well, but I guess that was the fashion of those days. And bring them to me. So all the people broke off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. And he received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool and made a molded calf. Then they said, this is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt. Now, you'd be surprised at this point if it wasn't a lightning bolt that fried them all on the spot. Because don't forget, the God was only a few thousand feet up the mountain at this stage. And they're all looking at this sort of golden bull and saying, oh, this is our God that rescued us from Egypt. So when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it. Oops, Aaron. And made a proclamation and said, tomorrow is a feast to the Eternal, to Jehovah. And then they arose early on the next day, offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Not good, is it?
Yep.
Bearing in mind that God's still there on the mountain. And, you know, Aaron obviously chickened out here. The Good News Bible, of verse 6, the latter clause says, the people sat down to a feast, which turned into an orgy of drinking and sex. Rose up to play, apparently, is a bit of a euphemism. So what they mean is, out came the bottles of wine, the lagers, the beers, the martinis, and a few hours later, people are doing what people do, running around half naked or worse, and all in the sight of God. Was that provocative? That would be provocative, all right. I mean, Moses blew his stack, and you know, God wasn't far behind. So in verse 7, the Eternal said to Moses, "Go, get down, for your people, whom you brought out of the land of Egypt, have corrupted themselves." Oops, finger pointing here at Moses somewhat. They have turned aside quickly. I mean, it's, you know, the echoes are still echoing from God's voice, the Ten Commandments. They have turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made themselves a molded calf and worshipped it and sacrificed to it and said, "This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt." Now, of course, Aaron has said, you know, this is the God that brought us out, and tomorrow's a feast to the Eternal. So it's almost like they were saying, we'll use this, you know, golden bull to picture the true God and worship it. All a bit confusing, but of course that's what people do today. Well, tomorrow, for example, is Easter, which is a pagan goddess, Ishtar. But many people say, well, we're worshipping the true God of heaven by having eggs and rabbits and sunrise services, feast of the Eternal, by doing pagan things. And of course that's not dissimilar to what Aaron was doing here. And of course you and I would never compromise with pagan symbols, would we? Verse 9, "And the Eternal said to Moses, I have seen this people, indeed it is a stiff-necked, stubborn, rebellious people. Now therefore let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them, and that I may consume them." The margin says, "destroy them, and I'll make of you a great nation." God meant it. He says, "Go out of the way, Moses, I'm just going to blot out the lot of them." So was he provoked? Yes, he was provoked. This is not how you deal with somebody who's got the power to make a universe and destroy a universe with his word. But they, you know, it was stupid, really. But unfortunately, it says these things are written for our admonition. And if we think we stand, let us take heed, lest we fall. So let's be pay attention here. Dropping down to verse 19. So Moses, you know, gets his skates on and comes zooming down the mountain. "So it was, as soon as he came near the camp, that he saw the calf and the dancing." And that wouldn't be ballet movements, I don't think. "So Moses' anger became hot, and he cast the tablets out of his hands," Ten Commandments, you know, "and broke them at the foot of the mountain." They'd already broken them in spirit. "And he took the calf which they had made, burned it in the fire, and ground it to powder, scattered it on the water, and made the children of Israel drink it." Now, he was somewhat narked. "And Moses said to Aaron, what did the people do to you? Well, did they hold a shotgun to your head, that you brought so great a sin upon them? And Aaron said, do not let the anger of my Lord become hot." A bit late for that. "You know the people, that they are set on evil. For they said to me, make us gods that shall go before us. That's with Moses, the man who brought us out of the land of Egypt. We do not know what has become of him. And I said to them, whoever has any gold, let them break it off. So they gave it to me, and I cast it into the fire, and would you believe it? This calf came out." So he ran out on his own feet and sort of just sat before them. So Aaron being a bit chicken here, because he could see that Moses was not well pleased. And of course we know God was not well pleased. And Aaron and the people were within an inch of being wiped out. So pretty provocative. And lessons there for you and I. you and I can't ignore God, behave before he sees us. We can't have his law, his ways, and just do our own thing. He watches, he sees, he's aware, he can be provoked. Numbers chapter 10 for our 8th provocation. So we're swapping books now. Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers chapter 10. Not much detail on this one. Numbers chapter 10, beginning verse 33 and reading through to 11:3. Verse 33, so they departed from the mountain of the Eternal on a journey of 3 days, and the Ark of the Covenant of the Eternal went before them for the 3 days' journey to search out a resting place for them. And the cloud of the Eternal was above them by day when they went out from the camp. So they've moved a whole 3 days now from God's mountain. Right? That's where the last episode was. 3 days. And don't forget, there's been big problems there. 3 days, surely you can go 3 days without grumbling, surely. Chapter 11, verse 1. Now when the people complained, it displeased the Eternal. It doesn't say what they were complaining about this time, but we know that they grumbled perpetually, continually, incessantly, and it got to God eventually. But the Eternal heard it, and his anger was aroused. So the fire of the Eternal burned among them and consumed some of them in the outskirts of the camp. So God was getting slightly less patient, and his grumbling and complaining. I imagine what's happening was that they were comfortable around the mountain of God. What, journey again? Pack up, move, 3 days on our feet, come on. Grumble, murmur, whinge. So God sent some fire in among them and burned some of them up. Then the people cried out to Moses, and when Moses prayed to the Eternal, the fire was quenched or extinguished. So he called the name of the place Tabira, meaning burning, because the fire of the Eternal had burned among them. That might be lightning or something like that, but a few of them, maybe a few thousand, they should have learned their lesson by now. The Amplified in verse 1 says, and the people grumbled and deplored their hardships, which was evil in the ears of the Eternal. One translation says, the people fell to grumbling over their hard life. Now, you'd never do that, I know. These things are purely hypothetical for us modern-day Christians. You'd never grumble. I'd never grumble over a hard life. I mean, look around the world, and 90% of the world, of course, lives in absolute squalor, and poverty and oppression. And most of us, by comparison, no matter who we are, live lives of absolute splendor. We live lives that are greater than the quality of lives that emperors had 2-3 centuries ago. Many of us have flown through the air, looked down over countries, traveled from one country to another. We can hear complete orchestras playing music on CDs in our homes. But do we grumble? Do we grumble? You bet we grumble. Okay, on to the 9th, which begins in verse 4 of Numbers 11. So still the same chapter. And Paul says the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that shall be revealed in us. I mean, grumbling is not... Well, grumbling, what grumbling means is we're unthankful. If you're thankful, you'd not be a grumbler. If you're a grumbler, you're not thankful. And you and I shouldn't be grumblers. If we're called out of this world, we're called out to endure hardship like a soldier. That's what Paul said to Timothy. Or like a hard-working farmer. But grumbling people aren't thankful people. Verse 4. Now the mixed multitude, one translation says riffraff, who were among them, yielded to intense craving. So the children of Israel also wept again and said, who will give us meat to eat? Is there any end to this grumbling? What are they not grumbling at? Moving for 3 days, no water, the water's too bitter, nothing to eat. And here they are again, now the riffraff among them, bad company, has set them off. and encourage them, and now they're all whinging over there's no meat to eat. Verse 5, we remember, oh yes, the fish we ate freely in Egypt, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic. But now our whole being is dried up with nothing at all except this manna before our eyes. Now, of course, don't forget where the manna was coming from. Coming from God in heaven. Were they grateful? Nope. Were they ungrateful? Absolutely. I'm sure they could have politely asked. I don't think any problem that they said to Moses, look, a bit wearing this manna. I really would appreciate it if God could put some different flavors in it or something a bit different. But they didn't do that. They grumbled, got bad-tempered, started whinging, started, you know, getting agitated and restless. And dropping down to verse 10. Now Moses heard the people weeping throughout their families, everyone at the door of his tent. So this was mourning of a high degree. Whinge, 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 set to music everywhere you went. Whinge, whinge, grumble, grumble, complain, murmur, murmur. And the anger of the Eternal was greatly aroused, which means it was greatly aroused, because he was the author of the manna, and it was a big thumbs up, you know, thumbs in the nose to God. Moses also was displeased. So Moses said to the Eternal, why have you afflicted your servant? Why have I not found favor in your sight that you have laid the burden of all these people on me? Did I conceive all these people? Did I beget them? You should say to me, carry them in your bosom as a guardian carries a nursing child to the land which I swore to their fathers. Where am I to get meat to give to all these people? For they weep all over me, saying, give us meat that we may eat. Meat, 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 meat. And so Moses is saying, oh, I didn't ask for this. I was happy out looking after the sheep. You know, I didn't ask for this bunch. You know, meat, meat, whinge, whinge, complain, complain, grumble, grumble. I'm not able to bear all these people alone because the burden is too heavy for me. If you treat me like this, well, kill me here and now if I've found favor in your sight, and don't let me see my wretchedness. Well, Moses is starting to get, you know, end of his tether because these people are just too much. Verse 18. God says, you shall say to the people, sanctify yourselves for tomorrow, and you shall eat meat. For you wept in the hearing of the Eternal, saying, who will give us meat to eat? For it was well with us in Egypt. Therefore, well, the Eternal will give you meat, and you shall eat. You shall eat, not one day, nor 2 days, nor 5 days, nor 10 days, nor 20 days, but for a whole month, until it comes out of your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you, because you've despised the Eternal who is among you, and have wept before him, saying, why did we ever come up out of Egypt? So God says, well, everything I'm doing for you, promised land, and look at you. And Moses said, well, the people whom I'm among are 600,000 men on foot, yet you've said, I will give them meat that they may eat for a whole month. Shall flocks and herds be slaughtered for them to provide enough for them? Or shall all the fish of the sea be gathered together for them to provide enough for them? How can you do that, God? You know, Moses is sort of thinking, well, there's 2 or 3 million people here. You can't get meat for these people. And the Eternal said to Moses, come on, has the Eternal's arm been shortened? Now you shall see whether my word will befall you or not. So we drop down to verse 31. Now a wind went out from the Eternal, and it brought quail from the sea, and left them fluttering near the camp, about a day's journey on this side, about a day's journey on the other side, all around the camp, about 2 cubits above the surface of the ground, so for miles in every direction, these little quail, birds as far as the eye could see. And the people stayed up all that night, all that day, sorry, all that night, and all the next day, and gathered the quail. He who gathered least gathered 10 homers, which isn't a cartoon character, but is an amount. And so they gathered, well, literally tons of the stuff. Once again, that was like, well, you never know what God's going to do. Better make sure we get plenty of these quail. So they were stuffing quail into all the cupboards, you know, under the bed, and in the sheets, and under their armpits, and their pockets. And they spread them out for themselves all around the camp, just greedy gluttons. No trust that God would look after them again. And verse 33, while the meat was still between their teeth, before it was chewed, the wrath of the Eternal was aroused against the people, and the Eternal struck the people with a very great plague. So he called the name of that place Kibroth Hataava, because there they buried the people who had yielded to gluttonous craving. Kibroth Hataava means graves of lust. So God did provide for them for 30 days, till it comes out your ears, out your nostrils, and you despise meat. Okay, 10th and final one, Numbers chapter 13. And we know the story here pretty much, so we'll just, I guess, summarize it. Moses has sent out 12 spies into the land of Palestine, the Promised Land, to come back and report on it. And if we pick out verse 25 of Numbers 13, and they returned from spying out the land after 40 days. So they departed and came back to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation of the children of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. They brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. And they told them, we went to the land where you sent us. It truly flows with milk and honey. And this is, it's fantastic. Look at the fruit. But nevertheless, the people who dwell in the land are strong. The cities are fortified and very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the south, the Hittites, Jebusites, Amorites, and so on. And Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it. But the men who had gone up with him said, we are not able to go up against the people, for they are stronger than we. And they gave the children of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants. And all the people whom we saw are men of great stature. There we saw the giants, and we were like grasshoppers in our own sight, and so were we in their sight. Chapter 14, verse 1. And all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. This is the 10th. This is the last one that God accepted. And all the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, if only we had died in the land of Egypt. If only we died in this wilderness. Oops. Wrong. Why has the Eternal Jehovah brought us to this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and children should become victims? Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt? So they said to one another, let us select a leader and return to Egypt. And that's provocative. Dropping down to verse 8, we've got Joshua and Caleb saying, if the Eternal delights in us, he will bring us into this land and give it to us. A land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Eternal, nor fear the people of the land, for they are our bread. Their protection has departed from them. The Eternal is with us. Do not fear them. And all the congregation said, to stone them with stones. So they refused, point blank, at the Promised Land. Verse 11, the Eternal said to Moses, how long will these people reject me? How long will they not believe me with all the signs which I performed among them? I will strike them with the pestilence and disinherit them. I will make of you, Moses, a nation greater and mightier than they. God said, that's it. It's over. I'm finished. That's enough. And Moses says, verse 19, please pardon the iniquity of this people according to the greatness of your mercy, just as you've forgiven the people from Egypt even until now. You know, the nine times already they provoked you and you forgave them. Verse 20, the Eternal said, I have pardoned according to your word, but truly as I live, all the earth shall be filled with the glory of the Eternal, because all these men who have seen my glory and the signs which I did in Egypt and in the wilderness and have put me to the test now these 10 times and have not heeded my voice, they certainly shall not see the land which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who rejected me see it. And so we know the story that happens thereafter. Everybody aged 20 and over died in the wilderness. 10 times, that was enough for God. 9 times he'd forgiven them. The 10th time, that's it. that's it. There's a time period, and they blew it. Let's turn finally to Romans chapter 15 and verse 4. So it's interesting this time of the year when we're in the Passover, unleavened bread, Exodus mode, to look at these examples that were written down for our learning and to recognize that they had a major problem with unbelief, rebellion, and murmuring. And hopefully you and I can recognize potentially the dangers there. Chapter 15 of Romans and just verse 4 in the conclusion. But whatever things were written before were written for our learning, that we, through the patience and comfort of the Scriptures, might have hope. These things are written for your learning, for my learning. So this season of the year, in the unleavened bread period, let's think back to our forefathers, the examples of those there on that Exodus journey to the Promised Land, and let's make sure that you and I, unlike them, do not suffer from a heart of unbelief. Okay, brethren, we'll conclude our Bible study there.